whether to what extent you are aware of being kind of shaped by the relationships with your siblings, whether that's, say, the eldest, or you're the youngest, or the middle one, or you're an only child. Who here is eldest? And if you were to come up with a word to describe what it's like being the eldest, the eldest child, what would that be? What summarises the experience of being the eldest?
Being responsible.
Yes, it is. It's about being responsible. What else?
Expectation.
Lots of expectation. Sort of carry something of the family name, don't you? What else?
Yeah.
Yes, theoretically, certainly. I'm not entirely sure that that's true, but theoretically you're in charge.
Yeah.
You're going to get to do things first. So that's the experience of being the eldest. Who's the youngest? What was that like? Give me a word.
Easy.
Yeah. Tell me about it. What else?
Suffocated.
Oppressed and bullied. Yeah, any more? This is what you did to your...
No, I was...
Oh, yeah.
I was the one who didn't really know what was going on.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so my little brother always pretended he knew exactly what was going on. Anybody a middle child? How would you describe that?
It's the best play.
Okay. All right,
so. You don't have to be
either of
those two.
Yeah. Can you go the word as well, can you? Because you're not sure... about your identity, but you're kind of always. What do you reckon?
So, you're constantly choosing sides.
Yeah, interesting. So you're kind of slightly torn. And does anybody know an only child? What's that like?
Expectations.
Yeah, that's right. You sort of get it all though, don't you? All of the expectations. But you never have to share, which I always thought was a bonus. I think we are defined by those relationships because they are so formative for us in a way that we're not that aware of. And you know, we love to think we're kind of individuals, we define ourselves, but actually those experiences shape us in tremendous ways. The story of tonight is the story of two brothers and their relationship with each other, which doesn't just define them, but goes on to define much of the story of the Bible, and in some ways kind of defines God's story in the world at large. It's a strange story, and I think if it wasn't for the significance of the characters here, it would be a tempting one to kind of skip over, because, well, it really is a quite sort of complex story where it's very hard to kind of work out what the moral of the story is. The Bible does this quite often, actually, but if you kind of come to the Bible looking for a kind of morality tale, you're going to be a bit disappointed, because the two characters in this story are hugely significant. Neither of them are endearing characters, neither of them seem particularly good as people, and I certainly went through a moment as I was preparing the sermon thinking, what on earth am I supposed to do with these two people? So it is, it's a strange story, but the reason why it's hugely significant is because of the younger brother, because of Jacob. And for the first readers of this story, for the first hearers of the story, the Israelites, they would have had a sense of identifying with Jacob, which I don't think we can really comprehend. Because Jacob, late in his life, would have his name changed to what? That's what his name gets changed to.
Israel.
Yeah, he becomes Israel. And he has some sons. How many sons does he have? It's like Sunday school's name. He has 12 sons. What are his sons' names? He has 12 sons, and those 12 sons are the 12 tribes of Israel. So for the first readers of the story, they would have been reading this and realizing that Jacob is the embodiment of them. This is their story. He is the sort of father of their nation, and he's an intriguing character. I don't know how you present yourselves, if you've you know, you've done an interview or something. Most of us do a pretty good job of kind of, you know, highlighting the positives, brushing over the negatives, and, you know, polishing up the general package to say, this is who I am. And we've pointed out before that the Bible never seems to do that with these figures. And this is, I mean, honestly, this is not a good picture of Jacob. But as the story unfolds, the next few chapters of Genesis, He's not an endearing character at all. He is devious, he's complex, he's tricky, he's deceitful, and yet for those first readers they would have been like, this is like the father of our nation. So it's a fascinating sort of insight into the sort of self-perception of the people of God, of Israel. If you've been with us over this term, you'll know we've been working through Genesis. And where we're up to now is, last week we looked at Abraham and Isaac. This is Jacob and Esau are Isaac's two boys. Isaac's kind of life, remember he had a rather traumatic experience in his childhood, poor old Isaac. His life is relatively quiet after that, which you'll probably be pleased about. But the significance is still there. God kind of renews his promise to Isaac and says, through you, I'm going to bless the world. Your offspring will be a great nation. So that promise to Abraham is reinforced. This sort of theme of struggles to conceive is there. So in verse 20, Isaac's wife Rebecca struggles to get pregnant, but eventually, as a child of promise, she becomes pregnant, and she's pregnant with twins. Now, I don't really know what the kind of whole experience of being pregnant was like in the ancient world, but clearly they didn't have ultra scans. And so this experience that she has of having twins would have been a fairly disturbing experience, particularly because they seem to be fighting with one another in the womb. And you can imagine sort of looking at her belly. I don't know what it was, whether she could sort of see the elbows pointing out or feel the kicks. But she's really troubled by this experience of the two babies jostling, so verse 22, jostling each other within her. She says to herself, quite naturally, why is this happening to me? So she goes to inquire of the Lord, and she learns this. The Lord says, verse 23, two nations are in your womb, and two people from within you will be separated. One people will be stronger than the other, and the older will serve the younger. You see that this is a story not just of two brothers, but of two nations. And what God is essentially saying is that this is a foretaste of what is to come. Jacob would become Israel. Esau, who is also called Edom, which means red. He literally was a redneck. And on so many levels he was. And he becomes the father of the Edomites. And again, for those first readers, the Edomites were at war with them. They lived not that far away across the border, and they would have had skirmishes with the Edomites. And so this story is a kind of foretaste of what is to come. The two boys are born. And I'm guessing it's just a kind of random event which comes out first. And Esau comes out first. And so he gets all of the privileges of being the firstborn, even though the two of them had sort of grown together in the womb. But then the sort of striking part of the story is that Jacob comes out, and he sort of rushes out straight afterwards, and he's grasping the heel of the first baby. And that's where he gets his name from. And Jacob means he grasps the heel. And I think this is where the phrase, you know the phrase, you're pulling my leg? I actually think this is where it comes from. You're pulling my leg, we've kind of taken to mean you're joking with me. But actually I think it means you're tricking me. And Jacob, you're going to find out, is a trickster. He is constantly deceiving other people. And the phrase, you're pulling my leg, comes from Jacob, who's literally pulling his brother's leg as he is born. And you get that picture from the very beginning of Jacob being out to get as much as he can from life. But strangely, as the two of them grow up, they are profoundly different. And I suppose this is not uncommon, but it is strange, isn't it? The two boys who are so similar genetically are so different in terms of their character. And Esau is a kind of rugged, outdoorsy kind of man, and Jacob is a quiet man. So verse 27 says, the boys grew up, and Esau became a skillful hunter, a man of the open country, while Jacob was a quiet man and stayed among the tents. And Isaac loved his older son first. Intriguingly, verse 28, basically because he likes, what, pheasants. He's got a taste for pheasant, and his older son is the hunter, so he kind of brings his dad the kind of food that he likes. And he's not a complex character, is he, Isaac? So he basically decides that he likes that one first. And not surprisingly, Rebecca, the mum, prefers the sort of quieter boy, the one who stays at home. But as ever, that kind of favouritism just makes the conflict between the two of them worse. And so we come to Jacob, and what appears to be a kind of gentleness and thoughtfulness actually turns out to be deviousness. And he has, who knows how long he's been working on this plan, but from verse 29 to 34, you get the story of how Jacob steals or deceives his brother into giving him his birthright. And so Esau is out hunting, he's clearly not caught anything, and he comes back and he's famished in verse 29. So Jacob is already there, he's cooked a stew, it's red, which seems to be attractive to his brother. I'm not joking. Again, Esau, not a subtle, not a complicated character. And he comes back, he's really hungry, and he goes, listen, I am dying here. Give me some of your stew. And Jacob says, no, not unless you give me your birthright. And Esau says, well, what good is my birthright to me if I'm going to be dead? I think he's also got a gift of being a bit overdramatic. He says, look, verse 32, look, I am about to die. Jacob says, swear it to me first. And Esau swears an oath, selling his birthright to Jacob. And obviously, in an ancient culture, birthright's huge in significance. It's the family line, it's the name, it's everything. So essentially, Esau gives up his whole inheritance for a lentil stew, which is not a great deal in any significance. Now, there is another level to the significance of that birthright as well, because Esau would have known that his birthright was the promises of God. That God had said, I am going to work out my purposes through Isaac's offspring. And Esau, who's the firstborn, is going to be the one through whom God works out his purposes. And so he basically gives that up for lentil stew. So, the old phrase is a mess of potter pottage. Does that ring any bells to anybody? It's an old sort of authorised version of the way. But that's sort of down in his culture. You give it up for a mess of pottage, and that's what he did. So that's the story. There are some other key moments with Jacob, and I just want to kind of pick these up because they're significant to this story. In Genesis 27, he steals his father's blessing again from Esau. And father Isaac is old, he's losing his eyesight, and he's about to die, and he says, you know, tell my eldest son, tell Esau, who in Isaac's eyes has still got the sort of birthright, tell him to come in, bring me some of my favourite pheasant, and I will, it's all about food this story, isn't it? And I will give him the blessing. And Jacob, with some help from his mum, deceives his father, dresses up in like a sheepskin rug, takes in the pheasant, and steals the blessing from his father. And again, deceives Isaac. And then, perhaps most profoundly, although this, we'll come back to this later because it's quite distinct in some ways. But in chapter 32 of Genesis, Jacob even wrestles with God. So he even tries to trick God in order to get what he wants. But that is different, and we will come back to that. So you get this picture of a devious, lying, grasping younger son who steals the kind of birthright and inheritance from the older son in order to get what he wants. But Esau isn't an attractive character either. It's very interesting that the characteristics of Esau are what later would kind of go down as the Jewish stereotype of what non-Jewish people are like. So what I mean by that is that Esau basically doesn't think about anything and just rushes in to do whatever he wants. He doesn't think of the kind of consequences of his actions. He's all about his kind of instincts and his feelings. So if he's hungry, the only thing that matters is finding some food, and it doesn't matter what the consequences of that will be. Later on in his life, he kind of goes off and he falls in love with two of the local women, decides to marry them both against the express wishes of his father. He basically just, you know, goes out into the world and does whatever he wants. Now, as with any stereotype, that's not even close to the complexity of the sort of human experience, but for Jewish people, that remains a kind of stereotype of what non-Jewish people are like. Esau despises his birthright, and despite the kind of generosity of God that he has experienced, he gives all of that up. So there you go, we've got these sort of two brothers, and you've got a story of kind of God's purposes, the big story of the Bible, worked out through these two individuals. And as I say, it's quite hard to kind of come up with any kind of morality from this. You know, like, I can't say, well, you should be just like Jacob, because he's a great hero of faith. No, absolutely not. And, you know, Esau is no innocent in this story. So I guess that I want that to be my first point, that if you come to the Bible looking for morality tales, you are going to be disappointed. The Bible is not the story of human beings and how great they are. It is the story of a God who works his purposes out despite the failings of humanity. Neither of these characters are morally good. Esau is headstrong. He acts impulsively without sufficient thought to what he's doing. Jacob is devious and selfish. He causes great hurt, and he causes great division in his family. After all of his deceit, he has to run away. It's significant that God doesn't protect him from the consequences of his sinfulness. There is no sense that we go, well, you know, because Jacob is, you know, becomes kind of God's chosen one, that God makes everything okay for him. Certainly throughout his life, Jacob lives with all of the consequences of his evil and his misbehaviour. But there is perhaps one significant difference between the two brothers, and that is, I think, faith. Esau fails, but in his failure, turns his back on God. That sort of thing of selling his inheritance is basically a sort of statement of, God, I'm really not interested in this at all. That's not a sort of moral judgment on him. It's a failure of faith. He rejects the promises of God. He counts as of little importance God's purposes in the world. He's only interested in himself. Jacob is not a morally upstanding figure, but he constantly comes back to God. And that story at the end of his life in Genesis 32, that story of him wrestling with God, is the story of where his name is changed. And I guess the thing I want to kind of recognise is that Jacob isn't an inspiration to us in terms of his behaviour. He's not even close. But what perhaps he is a challenge to us is his kind of doggedness in his faith. Where Esau is willing to kind of just give up on God, give up on the promises of God, Jacob, despite all his failings, keeps coming back and keeps wrestling with God. And of course, the thing that you know about God is that God is faithful to us, that he will not give up on us unless, you know, unless we turn our back on him altogether. Every time Jacob fails, eventually he'll come back around. And ultimately, I think he's redeemed. I mean, by that, I mean his sort of character is redeemed, that his trickiness is kind of, you know, good is brought out of that. And that picture of Jacob wrestling with God is actually, I think, quite a positive thing. All too often, you know, faith is presented as something which is essentially a kind of blind obedience, that you are told what it is you are to believe and you must just believe it. Whereas the name of Israel means he wrestles with God. And that, for the writer of this book, is a kind of conviction about what it means to be in relationship with God. It doesn't mean that everything's going to be easy. It doesn't mean that everything's going to be simple. And Jacob's willingness to kind of wrestle with all of the kind of complexity of life and of God and of truth, but to keep doing that is something which is celebrated. Throughout his failings, Jacob, eventually he's humbled. His character is changed. God doesn't give up on him. And eventually he does become this, this father of the people of God. And I think ultimately I love that story. I love that what we're presented with here is not a simple morality tale, not a story of be good and God will bless you. It's a far more subtle and complex story of God working his purposes out in and through human history, despite the failings of human beings. It's a God who redeems fallen human beings and makes something good even out of their failures. And I think that should be a real encouragement to us. You know, when we look at a church which is often failing, that God can work his purposes out even despite the failure of human beings. For you and me, as we kind of see the brokenness in ourselves, the ways in which we fall short, God can transform that into something lovely. God doesn't give up on us just because of our sin and because of our failure. And ultimately, this is the story not of human beings, but of God and his purposes. And I think that story kind of unfolds throughout the Bible. There's one particular phrase which I think if you'll see the significance of it, which is in verse 23. At the end of verse 23, where it says, the older will serve the younger. And if you know a little bit about the Bible, you'll know that that as a theme, it comes up all the time. And whether this is Joseph, or King David, or whether it's the kind of the pictures of the people of God as always the kind of the least and not the greatest. If you think of Mary, who was mentioned earlier today, if you think of the early church, God's continual commitment to the least of people is a theme which echoes throughout the whole of the Bible. God delights to take the broken things of this world and to transform them into something which reflects his glory. And if you will let him, he will do the same for you. And maybe that's the lesson we learn from Jacob and Esau. Don't give up, and God will not give up.